MediTalk with Dr. Ross Walker.
It's a Tuesday afternoon, each and every Tuesday afternoon. Ross Walker joins us. Good afternoon, Ross. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks, mate. Lovely to talk to you.
Likewise. Quick question here from Cheryl. She says, could you please ask Dr. Ross Walker what causes low sodium levels? Does it mean not eating enough salt? And how serious are low sodium levels?
It doesn't mean that at all. There's three different types of situations where the sodium's low. The first one is when you're dehydrated. So sometimes you'd be very dehydrated and you then need sodium and water to rehydrate the person. So say somebody's had severe diarrhea for a few days, they might end up having a low sodium. And another cause is when you're overloaded with fluid. So people have very swollen legs, may be in heart failure, may have what we call nephrotic syndrome, and sometimes the sodium's low in that situation. Probably the commonest cause of a low sodium is being on a diuretic for blood pressure. So there's many different diuretics are used, and that can lower the sodium. But here's the big kicker. The relatively common cause of low sodium in people who have a normal body fluid, so they're not dehydrated or overhydrated, is a thing we call the syndrome of inappropriate ADH secretion. And this has five different causes. One, it may be one of the drugs you're taking. So there are some relatively common drugs that can reduce the sodium level. So you basically have to look at all the drugs you are, go through it with your pharmacist or your GP, and see which one of those may be lowering the sodium. Number two is something wrong with your lungs, and it can be a serious lung condition or it can be a chronic lung condition with some other cause for it. Number three is something wrong with your gastrointestinal tract. So there are some weird things that go on there. For example, there's some tumours in the duodenum can cause a low sodium as well, as can a weird thing called a villous adenoma that can drop your sodium and typically your potassium. And then there's something going wrong in your central nervous system. So people who say fell over, cracked their skull, had a thing called a subdural hematoma, may have a chronic low sodium. And then there are some miscellaneous causes. So for example, an underactive thyroid can cause a low sodium, as can a weird condition called acute intermittent porphyria. So there's a whole lot of different causes of low sodium. The treatment is not to have more salt. That's just nonsense. The treatment is to find out which category you're in. If you've got syndrome of inappropriate ADH, you treat the cause, but also what you do is you reduce your fluid intake to 1,500 mils per day, but you don't have salt. Salt is not the treatment for it.
Emily says, I got the flu about 7 days ago, and I feel as though I have almost recovered. However, I still have a lot of phlegm on my chest. Mm-hmm. Dr. Ross, how do I get rid of that phlegm?
Well, the point is, and people say, I got the flu. There's not a lot of influenza around at the moment, so it probably is not influenza. There's a whole lot of other respiratory viruses that it may be. I had about 6 weeks ago the human metapneumovirus, which was going through at the time. So it's whatever the flavour of the month is. And if it's only a week, I mean, a week's not long. If the sputum is changing in nature, say, for example, Emily's sputum's going very green, then it's worthwhile getting a sputum culture, because I don't like people just taking antibiotics for the fun of it. I think you should be only taking antibiotics if you have a proven bacterial infection, either in your sputum or if you've got a sore throat. So many times people go up to a doctor, oh, my throat's very, very sore, doctor. I must have some antibiotics. No, no, it doesn't work like that. You swab the throat. If it's a streptococcal throat, yes, you need antibiotics. So with bronchitis, 90% of bronchitis is viral, so you don't need an antibiotic. So if your sputum's changing, get a sputum culture, and then if you've got a bug growing in the sputum, then some antibiotics. But a week's not that long, and it doesn't hurt to have a bit of a cough after a week. It tends to get better.
John says, I want to have a calcium score test. I went and asked a doctor, and he told me that they inject dye into me with a calcium score test. And he said, I told him, no, that's not what I want. What do I do? Help.
Okay. John is absolutely correct. The doctor is absolutely wrong. It's the same technology that what the doctor's talking about is a CT coronary angiogram, which is where they do inject you with dye, and it's not covered by Medicare, and it costs you about $800 to $1,000 to have that test done, and it is not a screening test for heart disease. The coronary calcium score is somewhere between $150 to $200, not covered by Medicare. It's a snapshot of your arteries, no dye, no injection. It's just the same machine. Now, GPs often get this confused, and they are wrong. People shouldn't be having CT coronary angiography as a screening test for heart disease. So he needs to go to a more enlightened GP and say, I would like a coronary calcium score. That's the CT without the dye. Please give me a form for that and go and get it done.
Okay, vitamin D. We talk about vitamin D on this program quite often. You have written an interesting article. That was your article, was it, that you sent through? Was that your article that you
it
sent
was
through?
Certainly my article, yep.
So you're talking about here with vitamin D, should we supplement vitamin D? Now, part of your article refers to pregnant women.
Yep.
Tell us more.
And what I'm talking about here, this was a huge study out of that shonky little place in America called Harvard, one of the great learning institutions in the world. And this was a 15-year trial called the VDART study, the vitamin D supplement or the vitamin D antenatal asthma reduction trial. What they found, and this is what I find really interesting, so just taking the vitamin D out of it for a second, I think good health is preconception to the grave. And this is the problem, that all of us cannot influence how our parents, how our mother gets pregnant in the first place, and what happens during the pregnancy and what happens during the first few years of our life. We're completely dependent on our parents. And I find that there's a lot of factors that happen around the time of conception that will still determine many things that happen even throughout your life. Even over the age of 50, your risk for degenerative diseases can be determined by how well your parents, both parents, were at conception and what happened throughout the pregnancy and what happened in your early life. So this particular sub-study looked at vitamin D, and they found that women who were pre-treated with vitamin D at the time of conception, throughout the pregnancy, throughout breastfeeding, their children up to 6 years old had up to a 50% reduction in asthma and allergies just by the mother taking vitamin D. Now, you think about how interesting that is, that a simple vitamin like vitamin D, which is harmless in a dose of, they're saying, somewhere between 5 to 6,000 units a day. So the conclusion of the trial is that all women considering pregnancy should be taking 6,000 international units daily of vitamin D. And I would say almost no women during conception are taking that amount of vitamin D. But they're saying it may have a profound effect on reducing the risk in your unborn child when they are born up to the age of 6, of reducing their risk for allergy and asthma, which occurs in about 10% of kids. So I think it's a really important piece of information.
Absolutely. There's growing evidence that cannabis use may disrupt adolescent brain development, but in older adults, it seems to lead to more neural connections in brain regions associated with memory and learning. What does this mean, Ross?
Yeah, see, this is really interesting to me, because I think health advice is completely different for people below the age of 50 as it should be for people above the age of 50. To give one example unrelated to cannabis, if you look at people who have a BMI, body mass index, below 25, which is considered normal, below the age of 50, that's a healthy BMI. But once you get to 50, it's been shown that if your BMI is between 25 to 30, which is considered overweight, you have a 7% lower death rate compared with people who with a BMI below 25 or a BMI above 30. So what they're saying is having a little bit of a belly over the age of 50 probably doesn't hurt. And it's the similar thing here with marijuana. Marijuana is a poison for a young brain. And these are people. This is a study done on people who used marijuana below the age of 22, had much, much significant changes on their MRIs in the area called the prefrontal cortex, which is associated with impulse control, which is why a lot of people who use illegal drugs or drink alcohol as teenagers and adults have problems being able to control themselves throughout their life. But this is another study done of 196 adults over the age of 65, and those who use cannabis once a week, and we're not talking about medical cannabis here, we're talking about smoking the stuff, which I do not condone at all, when they looked at the MRIs and compared this with younger people aged between 25 to 35 who weren't cannabis users, their brains more resembled younger brains than the older people who were non-users. And they did the same thing in elderly mice and found that THC reversed a lot of the damage to memory in memory-related brain structure. So I just found it a really interesting article. I'm not suggesting anyone over the age of 65 should start having a joint once a week, but I'm just saying it's really interesting information.
Artificial sweeteners, to use artificial sweetener or not. Look, we all know that generally we all, unless, you know, you're on a strict diet and you've given up sugar completely and you're very good at, you know, adhering to that, most of us take in our daily diets too much sugar. And what we try to do is we try to, if we're looking at losing weight, we try to replace that sugar with things like artificial sweeteners. What's body of evidence today? We talk about artificial sweeteners replacing sugar.
Well, the World Health Organization recommends that no one should be having any more than 25 grams of sugar per day, and that's not just the sugar you use in your tea or coffee, that's general sugar you get in your food as well. And that's the equivalent of having 6 teaspoons a day. If you had one can of a soft drink, you're getting anywhere between 10 to 12 teaspoons in the one can. And the average intake in the US of sugar is about 17 teaspoons per day.
Right.
So saccharin, as one example of an artificial sweetener, is 300 to 450 times sweeter than sugar. And they've done studies on all these different artificial sweeteners, aspartame, sucralose, the stevia plant, some of the sugar alcohols you get, such as sorbitol, xylitol. And interestingly, the World Health Organization came out and suggested that aspartame was possibly carcinogenic to humans, with limited evidence, but say it may even lead to liver cancer. A study out of France a couple of years ago of over 102,000 adults followed for 10 years showed that increasing the consumption of things like aspartame and another artificial sugar as a sulfame increased cancer risk, more weight gain, cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, and the artificial sweeteners causes the same degree of insulin resistance as using sugar anyhow. So there's all this work around the world to try and find a sugar that's natural, that's not as toxic as natural, as normal sugar. And they think they may have found something, a thing called allulose, which is the sugar found in figs and raisins, has a very similar taste to sugar, but 10% of the calories with no spike in blood sugar levels. So this work is ongoing, but my message here today is that I think we should all be trying to develop a non-sweet tooth. If you do have to use these things, just slowly reduce the dose to the point where you don't need them anymore. And I've got to say, I don't know about you, mate, but I don't use any form of sugar in my tea or coffee. And I just find it just far too sweet. I've never used an artificial sweetener in my life.
I remember as a boy, my nan used saccharin, I think it was. She used to have black tea so strong the teaspoon would stand up in it. And as a boy, I remember she used to have the little, you know, the little twist dial white thing full of sugar sweetness. She used to put saccharin in the darn thing. And I've never forgotten that. I've never used it myself. Unfortunately, I'm a sugar boy. I try to limit the amount of sugar I have. But when one does find the best vanilla slice in town, you've got to have one every now and then.
Well, mate, there's something you can't measure in your bloodstream. It's called pleasure.
Yeah.
It is important to have a bit of pleasure occasionally.
You bet. There's a new patch, and it uses natural body motion to fix disc herniation. My goodness.
Yes, well, I don't know too many people over the age of 60. You know, I'm about to use a very intense medical term here. Over the age of 60, who don't have a crappy neck and a crappy back. We all do. And back pain becomes such a big issue. And this particular study has only been done on goats. So it's interesting. I've never seen any studies on goats before. But they use this thing called a tension-activated repair patch. which has in it a very strong anti-inflammatory called anakinra. And they basically, I think they must have implanted it in the goats, in just over there where they had vertebral problems. And they found that the movement actually activated the release of this anakinra. So it actually works as you move and repairs any ruptured discs. So we're talking about a potential new way, rather than extensive spinal surgery. Maybe just go in, they put one of these, just a little bit of a limited surgical approach, put one of these patches over your spine, and it could be something in the future becomes the new treatment of back pain.
My goodness, wouldn't that be great?
Mm.
That would be fantastic. Tell me what COPD is, please.
COP is chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and right. It's typically caused by chronic asthma or, of course, that evil thing called cigarette smoking. And so people with some degree of chronic lung disease often find it really difficult to exert themselves. But this study particularly shows, a study of just over 400 people with varying degrees of COPD, and it found that those who had the least exercise or were able to perform the least exercise had the highest symptom burden. Now, that just may be because their lungs were so bad they couldn't exercise. But what they're saying is the people who had a regular exercise program had improvement in their degree of COPD. And I say to all my patients with chronic lung disease, have that 3 to 5 hours of exercise per week, build it up very slowly, two-thirds cardio, a third resistance training, but also do specific lung exercises. And what I say to people is they should be doing the yoga breathing where you breathe in, hold it for 4 or 5 seconds, then breathe out, pursed-lip breathing where you obviously purse your lips and breathe out against an obstruction, and then the opera singer's breathing, which is where you just move the diaphragms, don't move your chest at all, but push your tummy out when you breathe in. That opens up your lung tubes, and that helps the lungs as well. So the combination of the aerobic exercise, building up to whatever level that people can get to, the resistance training to keep their muscles in their chest, and the muscles in their arms strong, and their legs, of course, and then the specific lung exercises can certainly help your lungs.
Okay. Always great to catch up with Dr. Ross Walker. Thanks, mate. We'll look forward to talking to you again next week.
Good on you, mate. Lovely to talk to you.
Bye-bye. That's Dr. Ross Walker this afternoon. And if you've got any questions for the good doctor, you know what to do. Just send us an email and we'll put them to him next week for you.